Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. We're here again. This is show number 10. No longer in the tenderloin, and I'm missing it already. I miss the excrement. I miss the people laying around on the doorstep, and we're here in the Lower Haight, which is like a hipster central, and that's cool too. I guess we'll be able to go out and find some good things to eat later on.
It's not quite as primally entertaining, but
no.
It has its charm.
And we never did get around to the planned man on the street or person on the street interview in the Tenderloin. But I think those of you who know the Tenderloin could just imagine it and then be amused without us having to actually do it.
It's kind of a do-it-yourself kit. They can just go out and have their own interviews.
Absolutely. Just drink a bunch of Thunderbird 4040 and let it rip. So anyway, yes, we are here, and we're very proud and pleased to have a distinguished philosopher with us here today, Richard Warkey. And we'll be talking to him a little bit later. And meanwhile, we've got our gang of three, Jeff Deal, over there rubbing his nose and handling the twisting the knobs and twisting his nose. And Diana Brown back once again. Hi, Diana.
Hey, how are you? How's it going?
I'm
Jeff.
Hey, Anna.
How
not
are you?
Bad, not bad.
I'm loving your new digs here.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
So are you? I've been reading Freakonomics. Are you familiar with it?
Freakonomics. Well, I remember the Rick James song.
Ow! Yeah. This is not quite the same. Although I will admit, when doing some research on Freakonomics, the authors were, I don't know, they were sort of tagged as using an old-fashioned term, the onomics part, putting the freako in it to make it more interesting to today's market. But their subtitle is A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. And his basic tenet is that everything we do is motivated by incentive. We don't do anything for nothing. So one of the things I like the best about it, he breaks it down into little chapters. And one thing I thought was pretty interesting is he suggests why the decrease in crime has come about in the 90s. Because in 95, James Allen Fox, a criminologist, suggested in a report for the U.S. Attorney General that cases of teen homicide would go up, up, and up. But in reality, right after that point, teen crime started going down. And his research indicates that's because of Roe v. Wade, which can show that the effects of something may have far and subtle causes.
Now, I wonder how provable all this is. I mean, I like the idea that they seem to be taking sort of a whole systems approach to economics and bringing in more kinds of factors and, you know, might lead towards sort of a complexity theory economics, but seems very fragmentary at
even,
this time.
I don't need proof, definitive proof, but I at least need some kind of thread to allow me to apply the status of plausible to it. And so what is the plausible thread between Roe v. Wade and violent crime?
Well, what he cites, and, you know, I'm certainly not the expert here, but quoting the gentleman who wrote the book, he cites the fact that usually children who turn into teenage criminals don't necessarily come from the best backgrounds. And that correlates with unmarried teenage women having babies when there wasn't the opportunity to have an abortion.
That's great. So we're snuffing out the violent criminals.
I think that's what he's trying to say.
That's basically what he's saying.
Isn't it sweet? He goes.
I mean, there is a point. I mean, not just, you know, from people from the worst conditions, but also people who don't want children.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, and I can think of several women who didn't want my child, for instance. And maybe it's a good thing.
I think
I think they would have all been
how
violent.
How many R.U.s would
they,
be?
They would have all been violent criminals.
So how many little R.U.s have we been deprived
with,
of?
With me helping them, I hate to say.
Numbers.
Like
what's in a number?
Six or seven, maybe.
Six or seven.
Yeah. Well, I'm a mass murderer, according to
serial
Christian ethics.
There's another plausible thread that I could draw that has absolutely no basis in anything, because I've never thought of it before, but... and that is that in a general situation where a woman has an option with this pregnancy, then it affects how she raises her other children, how she lives, or how desperate or not desperate her life is, and that can help to ameliorate some of the conditions in which violent kids, you know, violent criminals are raised.
It's
without
true.
Giant drawing a direct correlation between the actual, you know, criminal fetuses,
right?
You know,
or you could make an economic case that the women were able to be more productive in the economy
because
they weren't having children at an earlier age.
This is true,
right?
But I mean, it all seems. I have to admit, I'm talking out of the lower part of my prosthesis here because I've only read about the book and I have watched the guy, the two guys on C-SPAN for about 10 or 15 minutes and frankly got a little bored with them. So I can't say that I'm a huge fan yet of the concept. But it does seem like, from what I've seen, they're sort of throwing out glib kind of, you know, connections that might stick and might not. And which makes for a very good pop culture book. I think of Marshall McLuhan in the 60s and 70s
absolutely.
Just throwing out these great glib things. I mean, in McLuhan's case, I think his Broadview was absolutely right on.
Yeah. But
a lot of the other stuff was just, you know, cool-sounding horse shit that worked for people.
One of the other things that I noticed in the front of this book was that...
Economics definitely has the sound of cool-sounding bullshit.
It definitely...
Well, I actually want to say that I'm angry at these guys for bringing this wonderful word freak into the sleazy world of economics where it used to refer either to people who are hardcore drug users in the 60s and 70s or to women and then generally people in general who like to fuck a lot in the 90s. And, you know, they've taken this wonderful word freak, which meant all those lovely things, and they've
made it something dirty.
They've made it dirty.
Sullied it. Yeah.
Made
it dirty by cleaning it up.
That's right. It's sort of the reverse cultural appropriation.
And they had to wait until Rick James died.
They had to.
Do it.
I think we should play some Rick James just to soothe the savage beast.
Yeah, maybe we will. We're pleased to have Richard Rorty in the studio with us here today. Richard Rorty is a distinguished American philosopher. He taught comparative literature and philosophy at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, just recently retired, actually. And he's been associated with a philosophical movement known as pragmatism. And by my reading, he seems to be at least a close cousin to postmodernism, although I'm sure we'll find out more about this during the course of our conversation with him. Major books include Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, published in 1979, and 1989's Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity. Let me repeat that again. Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, at least two of the three major themes of our age, with the solidarity seeming to be unfortunately absent. So, Richard, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I was watching Charlie Rose a couple of weeks ago, and he was interviewing a couple of contemporary architects, and everyone agreed that this is the golden age of architecture, that architecture has been building up on what had come before it, and that it's almost like a straight line of progress, and this is the greatest of all times. I'm wondering if you would feel similarly about philosophy or how you would see that.
I don't think it's a particularly important period in the history of philosophy. The 20th century had a few major figures, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, Dewey. But Dewey died in 52. Wittgenstein died, I think, 54. Heidegger died in 76. There hasn't been a great original figure in philosophy since then.
So why do you think that is? I mean, is there... Obviously, architecture is something that can be analyzed in some ways. I mean, it's a material product that can be discussed in those terms, and philosophy is more, I guess, ephemeral. Why is there not a sense of progress, or do other people have a sense that there has been progress?
I think in the arts and the humanities, it's entirely a matter of an occasional great imaginative figure turning up by chance. You know, you might get a cluster of two or three, you might just get one a century, but it's not a matter of trends or inevitable progress or inevitable decline. It's just the chance occurrence of interesting figures. Mm-hmm. I'm a little surprised to be told that it's a remarkable period in the history of architecture.
Right, frankly. I mean, that's debatable, obviously, but everybody on the Charlie Rose show, at least, seemed to agree on this idea, including him. There's a sense among some today that biology is in some ways replacing philosophy, or in some ways replacing everything, or at least rendering all past attempts moot. Do things need to be rethought in terms of evolutionary psychology, the idea of genetics and that sort of thing?
I think that philosophers began trying to come to terms with the results of Darwin and later the synthesis of Darwin and Mendel, and they did this throughout the 20th century. I don't think that there has been anything specially new in biology that requires any revision of the ways in which philosophers previously handled the theory of evolution. There's a lot of attempts by biologists to say, if you have genetics and evolutionary biology and cognitive science, you don't need philosophy. But scientists are always saying that. I mean, they're always saying the latest discovery in my field makes centuries of philosophical thought obsolete. It's almost never true.
Yeah, I mean, do you think tendency towards modeling human behavior and so forth on biology tends to be reductive, and that philosophy is in some ways a salve for that sort of thing?
Well, you can model it on... You can model human behavior on that of the lower animals. You can model human behavior on computers. You can model it on lots of different things. It's when all the modeling is done, it still doesn't tell you much about what human beings ought to be doing with themselves. There's no moral to be drawn from the story.
So I gather you think human beings should be using their imaginations and creating their lives?
They always have, they always will, and one thing that computer modeling or evolutionary biology or cognitive science won't do is somehow shortcut the imagination and take us to some place that the imagination has been slow in getting us to faster.
And you feel the imagination creates your life?
Well,
or in the telling of the story that you
your life is in large part a matter of the language you speak and the language in which you think, and that isn't the same language as was used 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And it wasn't biological change that produced the changes in the vocabularies that we use that differentiate us from our ancestors. It was, for lack of a better word, the imagination, creativity. And there's never going to be a science of creativity.
Well, you seem to, in some ways, oppose the idea of models, like there are models that can explain. And you favor narrative, basically. I mean, you talk about the novel as being very important.
Sometimes modeling produces useful explanatory generalizations.
Right.
But in the kind of explanatory generalization produced by empirical science just enables you to predict phenomena. It doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you the next move for human beings to make.
Right. But neither do novels necessarily, right? But they give you insights.
Novels certainly suggest new ways of doing things. I mean, revolutionary political manifestos, poems, religious prophecies, they all stimulate the youth to make themselves different than their parents and thus produce a human future that's different from the human past.
I mean, I've seen actually in my life a lot of people who have based political activism, political movements, technologies, and so forth on novels that they have read. I'm not sure whether that necessarily comes to a good end or not, but it is an interesting.
There's no reason to think it necessarily comes to a good end. I mean, you can base fascism on novels. You can base social democracy on novels. Right. What I don't think you can do is base it on cognitive science or biology.
Right. And there is no ultimate seat of authority.
Nothing is going to tell you which political direction. No scientific result is going to tell you which political direction to go on.
Yeah.
Intelligent young people have a choice of political options, which are made vivid by manifestos, movements, novels, poems, and so on, and they choose among them as best they can.
Right.
And there isn't going to be a discipline, either philosophy or science, that will do the job for them.
But is this correct that I understand what you're saying in a big way is, not right this second, but in your work, that there's no one system of thought that's going to work in a whole lot of circumstances, and that we don't need a rigid system of thought, although maybe historically you start with religion and then philosophy and so on. But now that it's the breadth of the imagination that will allow more choices and more informed choices in human behavior.
Yeah, that's about right. The way I tell the story, Plato invented philosophy by having admired mathematics, thinking that maybe you could somehow carry over the comprehensiveness, generality, certainty of mathematics into the realm of morals, the realm of what people should do with their lives. It was a nice idea, but it never panned out.
I was interested in a quote from Harold Bloom in one of your essays, which you seem to endorse, and Bloom said, "Only deep, constant reading fully establishes and augments an autonomous self." And by this, he meant novels, plays, short stories, and poems. So I take it that you wouldn't embrace a sort of McLuhanistic, post-literate kind of media-savvy intelligence as having some as not yet fully realized value. That is literacy absolutely necessary for autonomy?
I should have thought so. I never really understood what McLuhan's thought the substitute was going to be. And he seemed to me flailing around for a vision of the future, thinking everything was in the process of change, but never in fact came up with anything that was definite enough.
There does seem to be a decline in literacy, and I mean, in some ways we're an example right here where people, rather than reading books or listening to podcasts, or they have dozens, hundreds of different forms of communication that compete for their attention. And I wonder if that threatens to render a change in how people think about philosophy.
I sort of doubt it, but I can't cite any hard facts in the area. My feeling is that the same percentage of each generation reads books as read books in the past, no matter what else is going on in the culture, or at least hard books like philosophy books.
Mm. I'm glad you said that. I always say that about sex. I think behavior never changed in every generation, just the way they speak about it.
Yeah, probably the sex was the same, but the conditions under which it was conducted varied from time to time.
Right. I find that, not related to sex, but the more I read nonfiction, the more I also have to read novels at the same time. It seems like there's some kind of a balance in the psyche that takes place when you read fiction There's a kind of depth. But I guess you're not going to embrace any notion that I might have that things are radically changing.
I don't see any, you know, great cultural shifts. And there's a shift, there's a political shift to the right going on, obviously. Yeah. But I don't know how to relate that to any cultural development.
Okay. I think we need to break for a moment to hear some sounds, and we'll be right back.
Serious.
Back with Richard Rorty.
So I have a question. I like the idea of sort of embracing this notion of changing conditions from your parents, and also the rejection of what's referred to in some of your writings as Kant. But at the same time, in my experience, there's always a small percentage of people who are actually wired towards that, in that mode, you know? Most people, that's not their primary orientation. They are more likely instead to follow trends, look for some signal from an authority figure of one type or another. And even your comment about the same percentage of each generation reading in any meaningful way seems to indicate that there's always this built-in elite of people who are willing to change or mutate, and that they will dictate whatever changes occur for the rest of the people. Is this a problem, or?
I don't think it's a problem. It's just the way evolution works. I mean, there were always some organisms which had mutated in various ways, which led the species off in a new direction, or led biological evolution to take it turning. There have always been a saving remnant of people in the society who made the society different than it had been in the past. You always need an avant-garde.
But you have a position that there is no absolute truth or absolute set of morals, if you will. Is that correct?
Well,
that we're not here to discover that.
Yeah, I think in general it doesn't help to say there's something out there whose nature we need to discover, because there's never any way to figure out whether what you've discovered is really there or just apparently there. And the question, is it real or is it apparent, it seems to me is a blind alley. There's also, but you can substitute the question, is it useful, does it meet our current needs? And you can get some sort of decent argument going on whether it meets those needs or not. Whereas I don't.
A system of thought.
Well, this is the pragmatism people have attributed to you.
Pragmatism got famous for giving up on the correspondence theory of truth, that is, giving up on the idea that we represent reality more or less accurately, and intellectual and moral progress is a matter of representing it more accurately.
Now, postmodernism is also famous for that same basic assumption that there's no ultimate source of authority, that everything is sort of radically contingent. And inside some things I've seen, people have related you to this notion of postmodernism. And do you relate yourself to this school?
I don't find postmodernism a very useful notion, but there is. But part of what people call postmodernism is a tradition of French and German philosophy that goes back to roughly Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And that's just the European equivalent of the pragmatic strain in American philosophy that goes back to James and Dewey. James and Nietzsche were roughly contemporaries and inspired the same movements, because they both attacked the correspondence theory of truth, the notion of the absolute character of morality, and so on.
I mean, does this absolute character, does this depend, I guess, on a god? And would that be where the divergence would have been?
Nietzsche thought of the Enlightenment's revolt against religion as substituting for God a sort of surrogate called reason, or the absolute truth attainable by reason, going back to Platonic secularism as a replacement for Christian religiosity. And Nietzsche thought that the idea was not to have either God or a surrogate for God, but just to think of human beings as on their own, making themselves up as they go along. And Dewey had roughly the same view. So there are lots of differences between Nietzsche and Dewey. Dewey was a social democrat, Nietzsche was a fascist, but if you forget about the political difference, it's the same philosophical doctrine.
So do you think then people making themselves up as they go along would naturally include, or you would have to discover some kind of connection between human beings? In other words, if I'm making myself up, will I automatically understand that I'm connected to the rest of the species or the world, or are you posing that you could make yourself up and be a completely independent entity?
A solipsism or
something? Some people make themselves up so as to be isolated individuals. You know, the Byronic solitary poet, the hermit in the wilderness, Nietzsche himself. Mm-hmm. Other people make themselves up so that their identification with a community or a group or a movement is part of whom they conceive themselves to be.
How important do you think identity is in developing any kind of useful philosophical point of view? And it seems to me that identity is very important to certain aspects of left politics, for instance, particularly within the university, and that a lot of the identity politics seems to have emerged out of feminism and out of postmodernism. And I wonder if do you think this has been a healthy development, or where do you see identity?
I think that it's one thing to say people need to carve out an identity for themselves, to create themselves, and another thing to say they should take their identity from their membership in a group of women or gays or Native Americans or whatnot. These ideas are really opposed to one another. I mean, identity politics as practiced in the 80s and 90s in the university was a matter of telling people to be faithful to who they were, where who they are was established by their membership in an antecedently existing group. This has nothing to do with the Nietzschean idea of individual self-creation.
It seems to be in many ways anti-pragmatic also, I mean, in terms of moving people's attention away from resolving real problems and more towards, I mean, is that, do you relate to that? Or?
Well, I think that part of the multiculturalist, postmodernist phenomenon in the universities was a way of evading concrete political issues in order to discuss issues which could be settled within the university.
I think it came out of the disillusionment with, you know, quote, the revolution, unquote.
As we would invent ourselves as individuals, do you think, pragmatically speaking, a part of your self-invention has to be a sense of connectedness to other people in the world, in the sense that we're not going to get too far if everybody's here for himself?
Well, it's one thing to ask, how am I going to live my life? It's another thing to ask, what am I going to do for the future of humanity? And some people ask both questions simultaneously because they think the significance of their life will consist in what they do for humanity. Other people just want to be themselves and, you know, forget the future of humanity.
Well, I mean, that's my question, I guess, is do you think you can just do that?
Sure.
Be yourself and not give a damn about anything?
Some people have managed it. It isn't easy, but it can be done.
Yeah, it happens all the time. We need to call an end to this program, and we're going to have Richard Rorty back soon. I wanted to ask one more question. Contribution do you feel philosophy and yourself as a philosopher makes to our contemporary times and helps with our situation?
I think, as I said before, that there are only one or two important philosophers per century. The rest of us in the philosophy business just devote ourselves to popularizing their ideas, making them more palatable, presenting them in better flavored forms. So I don't think that there's a mission for philosophy as such, but in every generation there's a mission for the fans of James or Nietzsche or Heidegger or Wittgenstein or whoever it happens to be.
Okay, thank you, Richard Rorty, for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Are you serious?
We'd like to thank philosopher Richard Rorty for joining us in our new studio today. Our gang of four was Are You Serious, Diana Brown, Sherry Miller, and me, Jeff Deal. The Are You Serious show is on the Mondo Globo Network. Check out all the programming at mondoglobo.net, including Neophiles, Pastor Jack, and the brand new Junket 415, a local events show for San Francisco. Next week on the Are You Serious show, we'll be joined by Rob Bresny, author of Pronoia, The Antidote to Paranoia. This has been the Are You Serious show. Don't be afraid of the dark.